It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, why getting chatty with strangers could make us all happier.
First, we're focusing on the latest news about the VA scandal. There's a growing list of Veterans Administration hospitals being accused of keeping secret waiting lists that hide the delays veterans face when trying to get care. A federal investigation started after allegations came to light about long waits for care at a Phoenix hospital, which may have led to deaths.
This weekend, a hospital in Albuquerque, New Mexico, was added to that list of hospitals accused of secret waiting lists. A whistleblower at that hospital told the Daily Beast that Veterans Administration officials are actually destroying records to help hide the scandal.
On Friday, VA Undersecretary for Health Dr. Robert Petzl resigned. Critics say his resignation isn't enough, and he was already planning to retire later this year. And some are calling for the resignation of VA Secretary Eric Shinseki.
Dan Dellinger is with us. He's the National Commander of the American Legion. Commander Dellinger, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Rob, for having me.
So let's start at the beginning of this story. When did you first hear about this scandal emerging?
Well, we've been monitoring this for quite a while. It's you know, it didn't just start with Phoenix. We saw care being avoided or being postponed about 2 years ago on the East Coast down in South Carolina. There's been IG reports that we've been monitoring. And you know, of course, we always heard, well, they're fixing the problem. But evidently, this hasn't been a fix. It's a continuing situation.
So part one of the problem here is a long line for care at a lot of these VA hospitals. What is leading to that?
I really believe that they're understaffed. You know, they keep saying about what they call fee-based or contract services out in the public community, but a lot of these doctors just won't enter into agreements because the rates that the VA wants to pay them for these care just doesn't equal what they can get in the private sector.
But one of the troubling things here is that apparently the waiting lists are there, the waiting times are there, but people who work at some of these hospitals are intentionally obscuring the wait.
That's true. That is true. And that's very disturbing that they would do that. And then we've also heard allegations of doctors when if they haven't been seen, the doctors will actually delete it off the patient record and then tell them to reschedule so that they don't have that wait time.
And in some cases, I see that those long wait times are being entered as happening because that's what the patient, the veteran, wanted, when in fact it's all that was available to the veteran. How is that a part of the problem too?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. All these are contributing factors, and we attribute that, of course, to the leadership of the VA.
And we saw, as we mentioned, Dr. Robert Petzl resign on Friday. He was the VA Undersecretary for Health. Do you think that the Secretary of the Veterans Administration, Eric Shinseki, should follow? Should he be resigning too?
Yes, he should. We came out, the American Legion, the nation's largest veterans organization, came out with a resolution, and I had a press conference asking for him and the two undersecretaries, both Hickey and Petzl, to step down due to failed leadership and oversight.
When Secretary Shinseki took over back in 2009, he said he was going to tackle patient access problems, try to get these waiting lists shorter. Did you have high hopes? Did you think he was going to make a difference?
Of course. I mean, General Shinseki, when he came aboard, we had the utmost respect for him. We still do, as a patriot, of course, for his war hero. But it's entirely different being the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. He needed to step up, and unfortunately, we haven't seen that happen.
And we've been talking about the sort of bureaucratic problems here. How big a health impact has this had on veterans, these long waits?
Oh, it's had a tremendous impact. I mean, I get emails from veterans saying that they're totally disheartened by these allegations, and they just won't even seek care in the VA system at this point.
Really? So they see these problems and are not going to seek care. I mean, are you encouraging veterans to still work with the VA system as best they can?
Oh, of course. Of course. You know, we're partners with the VA. We always have been. I mean, we were there to help with the Veterans Administration was formed in 1930. We helped the secretary's job become a cabinet level in 1989. We've been very vocal in all of this to ensure our veterans get the best care possible. And we're still there. We want them to utilize that VA system, but we also want the VA system to step up to the plate here. I mean, they need to look at these allegations, not just the newest ones in Phoenix or now what we're hearing in Albuquerque, but some of these others. But this is the straw that broke that back. This has been going on for a long time, and they need to correct the situation now.
Well, apart from a change in leadership at the top, as you said, you'd like to see General Shinseki resign from his post. What needs to change, say, in the next year? What kind of changes would you like to see to move in the right direction?
There has to be a cultural change within the VA. They need to know that this is not acceptable. They need to know it from the top down. And the accountability starts at the very top. But the president needs to come out and state that this is not right. I heard him say that he's madder than H. But saying it and actions are two different things. And we need the administration right now to step forward and stand shoulder to shoulder with the VA and make sure that these things happen.
Well, the accountability side kind of covers up the covering up these long waiting lists. What would you like to see happen to lower the wait for veterans seeking medical care?
They need to better staff the facilities. They need to work with the veterans to make sure that when they need that they need this care, that they have the personnel there to do it. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Is that a funding issue mainly?
It is. I mean, some places where in America, especially in the western states, the VA officials there are some of the highest paid people in the areas. But you get to the East Coast, and that's not the case. And they can't use one solution for the entire system. They need to look at each VISN, and this country is divided up into regions or called VISNs, and they need to make adjustments there so that they have the available funds to properly staff and offer the services necessary.
This is getting a lot of attention from Congress. You yourself testified just, I think it was last week. Is this just going to be a passing issue for them, or sitting there talking to people in Congress, do you think they're going to tackle this issue and try to maybe provide more funding and deal with this as a long-term issue?
I think they will. You know, it's interesting that the Veterans Affairs Committee and the Budget Office had always wanted to give VA more money, but the secretary said it wasn't necessary. But I mean, that was based upon the figures he had, and the fact that those figures are not accurate. They need the secretary has now ordered an assessment of all hospitals. Utilizing that assessment, then they really need to sit down and figure out what kind of monies they actually need to properly run this system.
And then that's what you want from Congress. Is there something that the president and his administration could do this week that would give you confidence that they're going to really tackle this problem?
They have to give it more in lip service. They need to stand up. The president needs to make a statement. He's only really made statements through his house or the White House staff. He needs to come out and he needs to have a press conference. He needs to tackle this as a number one, as a commander in chief of this country, and make sure that the Veterans Affairs changes its culture.
Commander Dellinger, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it very much.
We've been talking to Dan Dellinger. He's National Commander of the American Legion. As a general rule, Americans tend to keep to themselves as they go about their day. We don't always make eye contact with strangers and smile or strike up conversations with clerks in stores. But now new research says maybe we should, because it turns out even casual, friendly interactions with people we don't know make us happier.
Here to talk about the benefits of talking to strangers and why it could up our daily happiness quotient is Michael Norton. He's Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School and the co-author of the book Happy Money with Elizabeth Dunn. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so it seems like in general, Americans think it's more polite to go about the day and kind of just leave other people alone. In other words, we seem to think it's better not to strike up conversations or chat up the person on the bus next to us. Are we wrong about this?
I think we are. I think not only do we think it's better to leave other people alone, but we also really, really think it's better to be left alone. The last thing we want to do is accidentally make eye contact with someone and have them talk to us because we fear that it will go very badly. But a lot of new research says, in fact, when we chat with strangers, despite our fears, it's actually better for our happiness.
Why is that?
It turns out that when we talk to people that we don't know, we have to try, which means that we have to be nice, we have to smile, we have to engage. And those are the kinds of things that after you're done with that little interaction, the fact that you smiled and tried actually is going to make you happier, especially when you compare it to staring at your phone with some app for an hour and a half and talking to no one. Talking to people seems to be better for us.
Now, your co-author on the book Happy Money, Elizabeth Dunn, she coined the term Benjamin effect to sort of get at this. Can you tell us about her experience with that?
So Liz had an experience with one of her significant others a few years ago where she noticed that Benjamin would be very, very engaging and vivacious with strangers. And then when the strangers left, he would kind of be a little bit grumpy with her. And I think we all can resonate with that. You know, we're trying hard to impress new people, but when we go home to our partner, we kind of lump around and sort of complain about our day and maybe even take a nap on the couch. And it turns out it's actually not that good for our happiness. And it makes total sense. Why would it be good for your happiness to be grumpy? Talking to strangers is actually better than talking to your spouse because strangers make us try a little bit harder.
So I guess that's the idea then. You put on the effect of being cheerful with someone you don't know and then you become more cheerful.
That's right. And, you know, when you smile at somebody else, it turns out, oddly enough, they'll often smile back. So it works to talk to other people. It actually, they'll respond positively and then you've had a positive interaction.
Well, I feel like a lot of people, especially in dense urban centers, have this feeling that, you know, they need to maintain their space and they're almost in this little pod and they don't want other people to break through that cone of silence that they're in. And that's sort of just how you survive in a city when you're crammed with other people. And if you don't do that, you could be stuck in an unpleasant interaction for a long subway ride home or bus ride home. How do we get past that?
You know, it's so funny because the research that is most relevant to this is researchers at the University of Chicago interviewed commuters who were commuting in Chicago, big city, not known for being super friendly, and they asked commuters, do you think it would be pleasant to interact with people on your commute? And guess what they said? No, it would be terrible to interact with people on my commute for all the reasons you just said. But then they decided, well, let's ignore them. And let's make some of them interact with people on their commute. And you know what? Let's call them later that day and ask them how their commute was. And it turned out that even though people said, absolutely the worst possible thing that I could do on my commute today is talk to the person sitting next to me, those people were much happier than the people that they left alone who just did their business as usual, meaning they looked at their phone or read quietly. So even though our intuitions are so strongly that really we should not talk to anybody when we commute, in fact, on average, it's much better to talk to people.
And what about the people who are talked to, the talkies instead of the talkers? Did they appreciate it?
It's a great question, and it's a real worry. So maybe it's that I'm talking your ear off and you wish that you were anywhere else except talking to me. They actually did another study where they looked at the happiness of the, let's call them the receiver of the chatting, and that person is happier too. So even though we feel not only is it difficult to start talking to someone, but we're worried about someone talking to us, again, on average, both people are happier than if they stick to business as usual.
Well, your student did an experiment where she also had people carry these clickers that would mark when they had interactions with people they knew with strong ties to them or weak ties. Can you tell us about that experiment and what happened?
Sure. It's a very, very clever experiment by our student, Jillian. She wanted to see, again, we have this strong intuition that what's the biggest source of happiness in our everyday lives? It's our close friends and it's our family. They're the people that we choose to spend the most time with. But she thought, I wonder if, just like with commuting, maybe strangers can give us a lot of happiness too. So she asked people to carry around a little device, and they had to answer how happy they were throughout the day. And they also had to click who they interacted with. They could click, One button if they interacted with someone they knew well, and another button if they interacted with someone who was a stranger. And when she looked at the data at the end of the day, it is true that interacting with people who we know well and we're very close to makes us happy, which is probably why we like to interact with them. But just as important for our happiness at the end of the day was the number of random strangers that we chatted with. That seems to be, it's almost like a separate source of happiness that we usually don't tap into that can be quite important.
So that made people as happy talking to people they didn't know?
It absolutely does.
Huh. So what, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but what if you took away the people that you were close to and you just were very friendly to strangers? Would that work?
I think that we, in a sense, we get different kinds of happiness from different people, and we tend to have the intuition that talking to people that we're close with will make us happy. And there we're correct because they know us well and we have a comfort with them. And where we get it wrong is that chatting with strangers, now they don't know us as well, so it's not the same kind of interaction. But as we said, it's kind of putting on that happy face with these strangers that we might not do with the people we know as well. It's an extra and separate kind of happiness. So my guess is there's probably an optimal mix of new and old that will make us the happiest.
You know, there's been a lot of thought and scholarship about American society lately, basically saying that we've become more isolated, sort of the whole bowling alone thing, that we're not that connected to other people. If we were to talk out with other people on the bus, to chat people up that we didn't know, do you think that would do something to combat the sense of isolation?
I think it likely would. You know, one of the interesting things about the social science research on social isolation is you can measure the actual connections between people in a community and see how interconnected they are, how much literal social capital they have. But you can also measure their sense that they're connected to other people, which is related to how connected they are, but it's actually a different thing. It's this feeling that I know and trust the people in my community. And that, independently of how well you actually know people, can predict how positively you feel about your town. If you have this sense that I know people and I can trust people here. And I think these little micro conversations that we might have, they're not really going to change how many people we know, because I won't sit next to you commuting tomorrow probably just by chance. But it does change my sense of how well I know people in general and how much people can be trusted.
We're going to get callers in on this in just a little bit, but it is interesting to think about this from a cross-cultural perspective. I know talking to people from Ireland or who have visited Ireland who say that, oh, we go to Ireland and everyone will talk to you there. It doesn't matter if they know you or not, and you have these pleasant conversations with people wherever you go. And I know that when I was in Mexico, we would get on a bus. You get on a bus by yourself, and the next person on the bus, even if the bus was empty, would sit next to you instead of far away. And it seemed like there were cultural norms that we're used to, I guess, in this country that, I don't know, it sounds like maybe you're saying some of these things that isolate us are making us less happy.
I think that's right. And even within the United States, there are huge regional differences on how much people avoid eye contact and avoid saying hello. It's cities in the Northeast in particular where people seem to really have the belief that the best thing to do is never talk to anybody. But people from the Northeast who go to the South of the United States or even the West Coast are amazed. It seems as though people are the friendliest people in the world, and partly it's just because they don't act as though you're not there.
Is it easy? You know, you've studied this research. You must have begun to try it yourself. What is it like to try to bust through some of these things?
People are amazingly willing to chat. It's kind of extraordinary how happy most people are for you to say, how's your day going? It really is amazing. In fact, when these researchers looked at the opening statement that people made to start conversations, they're the most innocuous things in the world. It's often, I like your shoes, or isn't it hot out? I mean, they're these really, it's not as though you need to have an amazing question to start a conversation with someone. Really, even these little tiny things that you might say to somebody else that they're happy to respond to, it's not going to be a 12-hour conversation. Even a couple of minutes is better, again, than staring at your phone by yourself.
And I guess that brings up a whole other question. You start the conversation, but you've still got 20 minutes of bus ride left. Do you have to talk the whole time? Can you stop the conversation, too?
Right. That's what earbuds are for, I think. Subtly put them in, and then everyone knows the conversation's over. Yeah. So, I mean, what we see, you know, when you talk to people is what they remember are the horror stories of being stuck on a, you know, transatlantic flight with someone who would, you know, not stop talking for the entire time. But usually the interactions kind of naturally end after a little while. Somebody starts reading, somebody starts listening to music. we focus on these very small percent of worst-case scenarios and forget really that most interactions we have every day worked out perfectly fine.
We're talking with Michael Norton right now, talking about new research that shows that we're happier when we talk to strangers, when we reach out, strike up conversations in line, on the bus, or maybe we even just smile as we walk by somebody on the street.
And we want to know what you think. Do you do this? Do you talk to people you meet on the bus, walking around at a store, or do you work in a store or a coffee shop? Do you strike up little short conversations with everyone? The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Michael Norton right now. He's the co-author of Happy Money, talking about some new research that seems to be telling us we'd be happier if we made friendly conversations with strangers, people on the bus, in line for coffee, maybe a friendly smile.
Well, is that describing your life or your worst nightmare? Do you strike up conversations with people on the fly, total strangers? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to the calls right now. We've got Jane on the line from Menominee. Hi, Jane.
Good afternoon, folks. I have run marathons for about 30 years now, and I would say my first marathons, I was always striking up conversations with runners that were in the race and also with people along the side. It just made the 26 miles go that much faster, and it truly was delightful. And what I've noticed in the last couple of years is that people are now plugged into their earbuds, and you can say hi or something to them, and they don't even know that you exist. And it's a much lonelier 26 miles is what I can tell you now. So I'm definitely picking up small conversations. Any load of in a day, much lighter, I believe, as well.
So interesting. Thank you, Jane. And Jane's getting at the earbud thing that we are maybe walling ourselves off even more. And it sounds like, Michael, maybe that's, you know, not the way to go. You're not saying no earbuds ever, but it sounds like that may be the wrong direction.
I think that's right. And, you know, the experience of participating in activity where you already have something in common makes it easier to start conversations. But you also see that you get two strangers to start talking to each other, and within like 30 seconds, they find something they have in common and start chatting about it. We're really good, actually, at finding things that we have in common and then talking about them for a little while. And that process of finding things in common actually can be pretty fun and interesting.
Let's take another call now. Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. You know, I really think it is a regional issue, as you were mentioning before. A number of years ago, about 15 years ago, I was out in Boston, and my friends out there referred to me as quaint. And I was curious, and I asked them why. And they said, well, because you talk to strangers on the street. and we're talking about nothing more than, you know, making eye contact and saying hello, pleasant day, and our lovely weather, something like that. And it was just unheard of to them to do something like that. And I was quite blown away. I'm glad I'm in Wisconsin where we're friendly.
All right. Well, maybe a Midwest-East Coast difference there. Michael, have you seen any sorts of differences like that?
Well, I'm trying not to take that personally because I am from Boston, but I do think that there are regional differences. And my guess is, though, that when you come to the Northeast and you are friendly, probably the world doesn't end. I bet the people that you were friendly to were happy to smile back and make eye contact. It's just we have this belief that we shouldn't do it. But in reality, most people kind of like it.
Michael, I want to ask you about another experiment that I think you did this one, too, on interacting with the barista at Starbucks. What happened there?
This is a very so you think about who can you talk to in your everyday life, and it can be difficult to start conversations with strangers because we don't know them and we don't have any framework to start a conversation. But my co-author, Liz Dunn, actually did a study in Starbucks where she just told people, go into Starbucks and either business as usual, you know, order your coffee, get in, get out, or why don't you try chatting with the barista a little bit when you order your coffee? And it turns out that people who chatted with the barista, and again, these weren't 45-minute conversations, these were very brief conversations, actually liked the experience in Starbucks better. Just chatting with someone who's serving you, in a sense, makes it a much more positive experience than just going through as though it's a factory and it's a transaction.
So we should, again, an example, we should talk to the barista at Starbucks and I guess whoever else we happen to come across during the day.
I think that's right.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to Greg in Waukesha. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Great topic today. I consider myself a peopleologist, which means I talk to people. I love hearing their stories and things like that. And I, too, go to a lot of coffee shops. And I'm also totally blind, but I just really enjoy talking with everyone. And I find that I get to know when I talk to people that I talk to people from different generations and different backgrounds in life. And I just find it very, very interesting. You know, I'll go to a coffee shop to end up doing some of my, I'm a freelance columnist, and I'll end up going there to write a column, but I'll spend most of my time talking to people. And I've gotten feedback from the coffee shop owners that they say, wow, I wasn't going to even give the time of day to that, you know, specific person, but you gave them, you know, 45 minutes to an hour of your time, you know, not tooting my own horn, but people have a lot to say, and I agree with this author. We just really need to listen to what they have to say, and you won't believe how many stories I've heard of people who've been in war, people who've been,
and,
you know.
And, Greg, let me ask you real quick before we get Michael's take on this. Have you ever been kind of rebuffed where people clearly don't want to talk to you and just wish you would go away?
Oh, you know, there are times. There are times when I will, obviously being blind, I'll hear, you know, people kind of playing around with their backpack at the table behind me, and I'll try to strike up a conversation, and people will want nothing to do with it, or people won't, you know, think I'm talking to them or something. And I've been rebuffed, and that gets a little hard, you know, as someone who loves to talk to people. So I don't let it bother me, though. I just move on and, you know, carry on with my day.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience, Greg. And Michael, what do you think about that? Just putting it out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is certainly the case that anytime we try to chat with someone, we're taking a risk. But I think at the same time, you know, if you think about it, we've been focusing on how these interactions can be a couple of minutes that are pleasant. But if you really think about your life, all of your closest friends and your partner, if you're lucky enough to have one, all started as strangers. You have to talk to strangers in order to develop these really close relationships. Most of them are going to turn out to be a couple of minutes of chatting. Sometimes, like the caller mentioned, people might not want to talk to you. But unless you bring yourself to talk to strangers, you're never going to meet the people that you become closest with.
And let's take another call. Thanks to Greg for that one, by the way. And on to Allie joining us in Madison. Hi, Allie.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good.
I just wanted to share, I'm a brand new teacher at the school in Madison, or I was this last semester, and the most terrifying place for me was the teacher's lounge, because I'm kind of a bit of an introvert, so meeting new teachers, meeting new friends was kind of scary, but I was so appreciative of the outgoing teachers that would come and strike up conversations with me and learn their stories, and I was kind of a flip-flop on your discussion about being the person talk to, and once I get into a conversation, I love and I find myself, I'm very happy with it, but getting things started is the scary part for me.
Okay, well, that's a great comment, too. Thank you, Allie. And she's talking about, you know, enjoying it when people reach out to her, because there are a lot of introverts out there, and this is hardest on, I would assume, introverts. Which also makes me wonder, is this sort of research sort of another strand of the extroverts are happier, you know, headline that we've seen in the past couple of years? What do you think, Michael?
Interestingly enough, the benefits of talking to strangers occur for both extroverts and introverts. So it isn't just people who are naturally interested in talking to other people who get the benefits of chatting with strangers. Sometimes, as Allie said, it's the people who are very introverted who actually get the biggest benefit from chatting with strangers because they're so reluctant and unlikely to do it. I'm gonna challenge Allie in the fall when school starts again to be the person in the teacher's room who actually chats with the new people and see how well it goes. And my guess is it'll go really well.
And Michael, in our last, you know, minute here, do you have any advice for people who might be a little reluctant to dip their toes in and start talking to strangers? How do you do it?
I think the approach to have in the world is that even though you believe people don't want to be bothered, in fact, most of the time they're perfectly happy to be chatted with, that people really like it when people say, hi, how are you doing? How's your day? And it doesn't require some amazingly brilliant pickup line to start a conversation. It is these little things that are just commenting on the weather or on the traffic or on why is the subway delayed right now. These are the little kinds of conversation starters that, again, you're not getting yourself into a, you know, 5-hour conversation. You're getting yourself into a small interaction that both of you are going to enjoy, and it's going to make your day better.
Excellent. Michael, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Michael Norton, Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School and co-author of the book Happy Money with Elizabeth Dunn.
Time for some talk about beekeeping in Wisconsin. Every spring, Wisconsin beekeepers swarm to Watertown to buy bees for their hives. Producer Nancy Camden went to experience the really big bee buy after the exceptionally long cold winter. She shares the buzz in this edition of Wisconsin Life.
It is real disheartening when you open a cover and find a colony of thousands of dead honeybees. My name is Chris Dempsey, and I'm the beekeeper.
And my name is Robin Campbell. You're dealing with a creature that has extreme amounts of variables within the insect itself, but then you're also dealing with the variable of the weather.
So here I am at my empty hives. The next step is picking up a delivery from Data & Sons in Watertown that I ordered in September, planning to double my hives this year to 20. Yeah, it's sad, and it's expensive, and, you know, it's a lot of work.
This winter in Wisconsin, it was probably about 2/3 loss, and some people, 100%. Matt LaForge, I'm the branch manager at Datant in Watertown. Today we're having a package bee pickup day, so the bees just arrived from California. They make the trip in about 35 hours, nonstop, and everyone is coming to pick them up and get them in their hives as soon as possible.
Well, it's just typical of when you go to pick up bees. A lot of the bees are on the outside of the packages, and they just fly around. They're not trying to sting anybody. They're just looking for their hive. That one behind your glasses, you could have got stung there because he didn't know where to go. My name is Hank Gettle. I've been beekeeping about 10 years. I'm from Blue Mountain.
This is the biggest package bee year we've ever had here, so it really is a big bee buy. A 2-pound box of bees is about $80. A larger 3-pound box is about $95.
Lee Heine. My job's the distributor. We distribute more package bees than anyone in the United States. We've had about 3,000 packages delivered here. They average between 7,000 and 10,000 bees a package.
Dave Marcy from Ogdensburg, Wisconsin. I'm the bee man. And I've been keeping bees for 30 years. When I get home, my wife and I will go out and I have things ready for them, so I'll get them in there as soon as possible. It'll take them a while to get situated and go out and find flowers, but I think they'll be sleeping in a hive tonight.
My name is Adam Raby, and I live in East Troy, Wisconsin. They did well till about late February, the last cold spell, and like everybody else, when we lost them, here we're going to try it again this summer. You know, a little more knowledge, we're going to give it a go.
All right, you ready?
Yep.
Let's do it.
Not all honeybee hives need to be honey production. It can be for pollination. They can just purely be for enjoyment and fascination.
My name is Riley Capel. I am 12. I'm from Lebanon, Wisconsin. Today we're here picking up our bees. This is our first year. We're just going to try it out, see what it's like.
We need our honeybees. A third of what we eat is pollinated food from the honeybees. You keep trying because it's an important thing.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org or the Wisconsin Life Facebook page.
For more on beekeeping and how to get started, we have Jean Hansen in the studio with us. She's a beekeeper, beekeeping instructor, and secretary of the Dane County Beekeeping Association. Jean, thanks for joining us.
I'm honored to be here today.
Well, before we get into the how of beekeeping, why did you get into beekeeping?
The reason I started was my husband gobbled up 7 jugs of honey, 5 pounds each, in one summer.
Wow.
And my friend said, why don't you keep bees? And I thought, yeah, for the price of that, I could have the bees myself and have all the fun of making the honey.
So how hard is it to get started from scratch when you know nothing about bees starting out?
It takes a little study. The wrong way to get started would be to take a 3-hour beekeeping class and then go to the store and say, give me what I need. Beginners have so many decisions they need to make. So a person should read a few books from the library, find a local bee club, get to know some beekeepers, talk to people. They would be happy to show you their hives and let you watch while they work on them. So if you would spend a season getting to know beekeeping, then it's not too hard.
And that's the first decision, is whether to do it at all. What kind of questions, as somebody is working with that beekeeping group and reading up, what kind of questions should we ask ourselves before taking the plunge?
I think you have to be a person who enjoys being outdoors, enjoys working with Mother Nature, a person who enjoys learning something new.
Those are the keys. All right.
Now, I have a secret ambition, not so secret anymore, to be a beekeeper. I'd love to keep bees. I love bees. Do you have to ask your neighbor's permission? Do you have to go door to door and say, by the way, there's going to be about 700 bees moving in next door to you?
The neighbors depends a lot on your personality and your relationship with the neighbors you have. It's, of course, polite to tell the neighbors that you plan to put in bees, but the ordinance in Madison allows you to have them. So we urge all our beekeepers to be good neighbors. Keep the bees in the center of the yard. Don't use them to annoy the neighbors. But in general, the ordinance allows you to have bees.
Is there a way to start small, and how small is small when you're getting into beekeeping?
We recommend that people start with 2 hives, because one can have a problem and the other one can be strong, and then you'll notice the difference. One can swarm and the other one might not. But a lot of beginners do start with only 1 hive and have good luck.
What do you mean one can swarm and the other one won't? What does that mean?
So the way bees reproduce in nature, when the hive has got a lot of bees and there's plenty of flowers and lots of nectar available, the bees send the queen and half the bees away in a swarm, and they found a new colony in a new cavity someplace, and the other half of the bees stay behind and make a new queen for themselves. So to propagate the species, the bees swarm. They divide the hive into 2 in order to get an extra one.
Well, we heard about that bee buy in Watertown. Everybody in that story, they're picking up their bees for the season. Are there places like that all over the state where people can order bees for the season?
I think the one in Watertown is the largest, but yes, there are package bee dealers in many places in the state.
And what are some of the most common problems or mistakes people make when they're just starting out?
Well, the problems are a little different from the mistakes. We all have a few little mistakes. When we start, we all are all thumbs. The problems have to do with keeping your bees alive over winter. Mm. This is the biggest challenge. And there, the bees need a good queen, plenty of honey, and disease-free. When you buy your package, she's got a good queen. It's relatively easy to know to leave lots of honey for your bees. But knowing whether or not they're sick or they have mites or they're diseased, that's the hardest part. But you'll definitely have bees your first summer, and you'll learn a lot and enjoy them. And then they could die.
You know, I wonder, you mentioned going to local bee organizations for help. It seems like I know if I did this, I'd get a lot of things wrong, construct the hive, whatever you call it, wrong. I wouldn't even know the right words. Are people in the bee community like willing to like stop by and say, hey, Rob, here are the 3 things you got to fix or you're doomed here?
We have a very active club, and just about anybody who calls for help gets a volunteer who lives close to them and will come over and explain things. And we also have plenty of beekeepers who are willing to let you come to their place and look at their hives.
Do you get fond of your bees? Do you go, oh, here's Stanley and Laszlo or whatever you call them? Do you get to know them, or are they just kind of, you know, like maybe like a farm animal, a herd of cattle?
A beehive is like a super organism. With 60,000 bees, I can't get to know one bee in the hive, but I have three hives, Jean, Paula, and Becky. And I know that Jean is a little weak, and I know that Becky is a humming hive, and so I'm really happy with Becky. And Paul is kind of in between. So I get to be friends with the hives, mm-hmm. but not the individual bees.
Mm-hmm. Now, given how you got started with a honey-consuming husband, I'm sure this is a question you heard a lot. How long until you can start harvesting honey?
You should be able to get some honey your first year.
Really?
Enough, a few bottles for you to use for your family.
Nice. How complicated is that process? You've got your hives, you've got your bees. How do you get the honey into eatable form?
The bees put the honey in comb on the edges of the nest. So it's really easy to lift a comb of honey out of the hive, brush the bees off, take it into the house, and mash up the combs, and the honey drips out of it. That's all there is to it.
That's it. Are there bee parts in it?
No, there's not bee parts in it. But there could be little scraps of wax, so okay. We strain it.
Jean, you got into this to meet your household honey needs. What do you get out of it now? What satisfies you about beekeeping as a hobby?
I've never had so much fun learning about bees as an insect, learning about the flowers that they need for the nectar, watching the weather because they can't fly on rainy, well, they can fly, but on rainy days, the nectar has been washed out of the flowers, and when it's chilly, they don't fly, and just there's so much satisfaction in the whole operation of keeping bees, not to mention the wonderful people I've met in the process.
So that Winnie the Pooh scenario where the bees all come running after you in an angry swarm and they chase you around the block or whatever, that doesn't really happen, right?
That doesn't really happen. Maybe once in a blue moon a beekeeper has some kind of a problem. But in general, the bees have been bred for centuries to be very docile and calm and gentle.
Excellent. Well, thanks for the pep talk, Jean. Thanks for joining us. That was beekeeper and beekeeping instructor Jean Hansen.